On the matter of Islam and science, Harris makes the following observations. 1. Although the Islamic civilization was more advanced than the Christian West, that was 1,000 years ago. Harris is far from being the only person to promote this idea, so I feel it deserves its own label. I'm calling it the Moribund Muslim Millennium Thesis. 2. Any science Muslims did do, prior to their moribund millennium, was done only to assist their religious practice. They did not utilize science to benefit humanity as a whole. This idea has also been out there for a while. The selective Saracen science theory, perhaps? 3. Science is a Western invention. And 4. In our time, small pockets of American real estate have contributed more science, besides other items of endearing value for mankind, than was produced during the entire Moribund Muslim millennium. In other words, what the West did and does is best and better than what Muslims did and do. We can combine these last two points under the heading, Science of the West is Best. Let's now address each observation in turn.
Yes, it is true to say that a millennium ago, the Muslim world was ahead of the Christian West.
Only a millennium ago? This implies that the Christian West overtook Islam from around 1000 CE onwards. But earlier, we had this dude suggesting that Islam led the world scientifically for 1000 years, which would take us into the 1600s. Considering the overlap is a huge 600 years, both positions cannot be held simultaneously. Did Ben Kingsley get all dressed up for nothing? Or is Harris the one peddling fiction? As was mentioned earlier, Harris is not the author of this theory. It may be that he acquired it from his friend and fellow atheism advocate, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
12th century kicks in, and then you get the influence of this scholar, Al-Ghazali. All right? And so out of his work, you get the philosophy that mathematics is the work of the devil. And nothing good can come of that philosophy. That, combined with other sort of codification, philosophical codifications of what Islam was and would become, the entire intellectual foundation of that enterprise collapsed, and it has not recovered since. Over that period, all these books were translated into Arabic on a scale not seen since then. But we all know tomorrow's economies will be founded on innovations in science and technology, and of course that gets cut short if we lose our civilization, as what happened in Islam in 1100. Had Islam not collapsed in its intellectual standing in the year 1100, and you just do the ratios, they would have every single Nobel Prize today. So the fact that it's not only just a few, it's near zero, is deeply worrying. I'm concerned about what lost, what brilliance may have expressed itself and did not in that community over the past 1,000 years.
Tyson does not just perpetuate the idea that Islam's romance with science ended 1,000 years ago, give or take a century, he also attributes it to a particular cause, the Muslim theologian Al-Ghazali. But Tyson is mistaken on 3 points. Firstly, it's a mischaracterization of Ghazali to say he was opposed to the study of the natural sciences in and of themselves. His beef was more precisely with the association of science with the philosophers. Philosophy, or falsafa in Arabic, sometimes was an umbrella term for philosophy, mathematics, and physics together. So long as one could divorce the actual science from the pseudoscience of the philosophers, it ceased to be an issue.
Al-Ghazali thought about sciences in a very, very modern way. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly even a surprise to me, but it was probably more a surprise to other people who always thought that Al-Ghazali was one of the people who had destroyed the sciences in Islam. I think nothing is further from the truth. In fact, he is someone who supported the sciences, who wanted to find a cosmology that actually leads to, first of all, acknowledging God as the creator of the world, but also in helping scientists to pursue the sciences. So in a nutshell, one might say he thought in his cosmology, of course, which did not have the Big Bang, but if we would translate his cosmology to the Big Bang as God as the creator of the Big Bang. God created the Big Bang, and from that moment on, all the causes and effects that have unfolded since then with necessity are mediated God's creation. In this case, God deliberately chose, one might say, how to create the Big Bang. And everything that has happened since then is, in this case, a causal effect of this one event that God actually put into this world, which I thought was a very fitting way for a theologian to think about this universe.
Ghazali's position against the philosophers was itself, however, very confused and ultimately self-defeating. He would refute specific aspects of philosophy that he found objectionable, but incorporate other aspects into his theology that he didn't, whilst further relying upon Aristotelian categories as part of his Kalam methodology in refuting the philosophers. For example, Ghazali wrote, "Geometry and arithmetic, both are permissible, and no one is barred from them except the person who might be led by their study towards blameworthy sciences, for most of those who practice them have transgressed into bid'ah, innovation. Thus, the one who is weak in faith is barred from their study, just as the boy is barred from the river bank, lest he should fall into the water." Due to this, a person could be forgiven for thinking that Ghazali was opposed to rational science. He confused mathematics, of which geometry and arithmetic are branches, with the blameworthy pseudosciences. Ghazali excommunicated philosophers such as Kindi, Farabi, and Avicenna, Ibn Sina, due to their wholesale adopting Greek philosophy and giving it an authority above revelation. But it was not mathematics which corrupted and nullified the iman of the philosophers. It was pagan metaphysics, or theophilosophy, as I call it, aspects of which Ghazali himself adopted and advocated, like Ashuris do in general. In other words, Ghazali failed to distinguish the physics from the metaphysics. He recognized the disease and its symptoms, but gave the wrong prognosis, and allowed himself to get infected. This is why Ghazali's own protege, Abu Bakr ibn al-Arbi, said about his teacher, "Our Sheikh Abu Hamid swallowed the philosophers, and then wanted to vomit them out, but he couldn't." Or as the Andalusian scholar, Abu Bakr al-Tartushi warned, "The one who seeks to aid the deen of Islam with the opinions of the philosophers and the views of the people of Greek logic, is like the one who washes clothing with urine." This paradox, adopting the beliefs of those whom he was trying to refute, Ghazali manifested throughout his life, including in his other great venture, Sufism. After suffering a crisis of faith, Ghazali became something of a recluse. His religious convictions wavering, he wandered off into the wilderness to find himself. It was during his sojourn from scholarship that Ghazali deep-dived into pantheistic Sufism, aimlessly adopting some of the very occult beliefs and practices of the Ba'athini Shiites he had been previously refuting. Sufism, so-called Islamic mysticism, has its main pedigree in Gnosticism. The Gnostics were an offshoot from Christianity whose beliefs were a synthesis of Greco-Roman pantheism with an esoteric path towards knowing, or gnosis in Greek. Knowing what, exactly? Knowing that God and the world are one. Astaghfirullah.
Subhanallah amma yushrikun.
Glory be to Allah. High is He above what they ascribe to Him. The main difference between the Gnostic and Trinitarian conceptions of the divine is that the Trinity restricts a belief of God's incarnation within the material world to the person of Jesus Christ, i.e., God made flesh. Astaghfirullah. Whilst Gnosticism holds to an unrestricted, universe-wide incarnation of the divine. Extreme Sufis, and by that I mean pantheistic Sufis, not merely aesthetics, likewise believe in Wahdat al-Wujud, the so-called oneness of Allah with His creation. This is how Sufis understand and explain Tawheed. To them, La ilaha illallah, there is no deity except Allah, means there is no existence except Allah, or all that exists is Allah. Astaghfirullah.
God is everything. This is one of the basic experiences, not just of Sufism, but the core of every mystical path is the oneness. Everything is God. There is nothing other than God.
Subhanahu wa ta'ala amma yaquluna 'uluwan kabira.
Glory be to Him, and exalted be He in high exaltation above what they say. The other main influence in the development of extreme Sufism was the Ismaili branch of extreme Shiaism, which had become widespread in the 11th century. One of the Ismailis core tenets is esotericism, taking a secret, hidden or inner path towards divine truth. This is why they were also known as the Batiniya, al-Batin being one of the names of Allah, meaning the hidden one. And like the Gnostics and the Batiniya before them, extreme Sufis believe that only through esotericism can a select few achieve and reach an experiential knowledge of the divine, to the extent that Allah's alleged hulul, his indwelling or incarnation in the slave, manifests itself. Astaghfirullah. This pantheism found its way into Ghazali's post-walkabout writings, including through his promotion of Sufi heretics, such as Sahal bin Abdullah at-Tustari, who said, when asked about the secret of the soul, "The soul is the secret of Allah. That secret has been manifested to none except Pharaoh, because he said, 'Ana Rabbukum al-A'la,' I am your Lord, Most High." The blasphemy here should not require any commentary.
Subhana Rabbika Rabbil Izzati Amma Yasifun.
Glorified be your Lord, the Lord of honor and power, above what they attribute to him. Thus, Ghazali's final theology represented an amalgamation of Batini pantheistic Sufism with Ash'arism, which, if we recall, was formulated by Imam al-Ash'ari before his return to traditionalism, and as a reaction to the theophilosophy of the Mu'tazilites, whose creed was itself the distillate of Islam passed through the filter of Aristotelian metaphysics, all of which is far removed from the monotheism of the Messenger Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam. Now, if Tyson wants to accuse Ghazali of opposing intellectual and scientific pursuit more exactly, this quote might suffice him. The Sufi master, Junaid, said, "I recommend the beginner murid, the Sufi disciple, not to preoccupy his heart with three. Otherwise, his status will change. Seeking provision, seeking knowledge of the hadith, and marriage." And he said, "I prefer the Sufi not to read or write, because it is safer and sound for his intention and practice." Ironically, the passage where these words appear begins by stressing the virtue of marriage and how it is part of the religion, and how for some it can even be compulsory. Yet the passage ends with the above. This again exemplifies the contradiction and confusion we're speaking of. And this was the genius of Ghazali, his making inherently contradictory and heterodox beliefs accessible and somehow palatable to the unsuspecting masses. This he achieved largely through his most famous tome, Ihya Ulum al-Din, the revival of the sciences of the religion. Ghazali's Ihya is a book of Sunni jurisprudence of the Shafi'i school mixed with Sufi occultism. Quranic verses are interspersed with fantastical fables of holy men and an unacceptable number of weak and fabricated hadith. As Imam at-Tirtushi said, "I do not know any book on the surface of the earth which attributes more lies to the Prophet than this one." Ghazali's synthesis of heresies included the convergence of two unrelated drivers of elitism. The first, that of the Ash'ari advocacy of Kalam for those select few possessing the requisite scholastic and intellectual fortitude. The second, the Sufis' quest for an experiential state of Gnosis through union with God, a station so exclusive that only Pharaoh sussed it, allegedly. The question is, did Ghazali return to Sunni orthodoxy before his death, like so many others from the people of Kalam, including, as we saw, Ghazali's own teacher, Imam al-Jawaini, who wept with regret for having wasted his years in Kalam, or Imam al-Ash'ari, who hoped to be counted in the ranks of Ahl Sunnah behind Imam Ahmad? It may come as a surprise to many in today's age of pick-and-mix aqidah, but in pre-modern times, no Sunni theologian could claim legitimacy except that they ascribe to the madhab, the school of the Salaf al-Salih, the pious predecessors, meaning the first three generations of Muslims who were praised in the revelation, even if that ascription did not go beyond mere lip service. And Ghazali was no different.
And he says, "But knowledge of the akhirah, the afterlife, this is the path of the Salaf al-Salih." You know, people talk about the Salafiyyah. This whole book is to get back to the Salafiyyah. This is the manual to get back to the way of the Salaf. That's what he's saying. He's saying the way of the Salaf is gone. They're right. The people that say people aren't following the Salaf anymore, this is exactly Imam al-Ghazali's argument. But he's saying what you think is what is the Salaf is not what is the Salaf. What you think is not knowledge.
In his final work, less than a fortnight before his passing, Ghazali wrote a medium-sized book of only 3 chapters. The first chapter is entitled, The Creed of the Salaf Regarding the Reports Concerning Allah's Attributes. The first sentence of which reads, Know that the unequivocal truth over which there is no dispute between the people of insight is found in the madhab, the school of the Salaf, meaning the madhab of the companions and the successors. The second chapter is entitled, Establishing the Comprehensive Proof that Truth is the Madhab of the Salaf, and that whoever opposes them is an innovator. Based on this, some have taken this final work of Ghazali's as evidence of his recanting from his past pursuit of Kalam, his Ashari Aqidah, and his Sufism, as these matters were all innovated into the religion after the passing of the companions, and were opposed by those of the Salaf who witnessed their beginnings. For example, Imam al-Shafi'i famously said, لو أن رجلا تصوف أول النهار لا يأتي ظهر حتى يصير أحمق. If a person practices Sufism in the morning, he does not return at noon except an idiot. And he said, ما لزم أحد صوفية 40 يوما فعاد أقله إليه أبدا. No one who remained a Sufi for 40 days ever had his brain returned to him. However, followers of Ghazali dispute that his final book indicates that he turned his back on Kalam, and I am inclined to agree with them. Although the book is devoid of any mention of Sufism, Ghazali does encourage the reader to consult Ihya, which does. Furthermore, the clue is in the title of the book, Iljam al-Awam an Ilm al-Kalam, which means Restraining the Laity from Speculative Theology. In other words, he was only discouraging the common people from indulging in Kalam, not the elite, the capable of the scholars and jurists themselves. Here, Ghazali was remaining consistent to Ashari exclusionism. The ever insightful Imam al-Albani was asked,
خطوات بطيئة جدا وقليلة نحو ذلك وعسى الله عز وجل أن يكون تاب عنه وعن أمثاله من أهل العلم. نعم.
All of which shows that if one wanted to evidence Ghazali's encouraging the pursuit of maths and science and of acquiring Islam from the Quran and the Sunnah in the way of the Salaf, they could find all that in his works. And if one wanted to find Ghazali discouraging all of the above, that could also be evidence from the same works. So on this specific point, we can maybe give Tyson a pass. However, there is a stronger second counter to Tyson's argument. Even if in his confused efforts to refute philosophers, Ghazali somehow managed to dissuade his followers from the rational sciences and mathematics, to suggest that one man could be responsible for the supposed collapse of scientific investigation and technological innovation across disparate and rival Muslim empires spanning 3 continents is incredible, as in, not credible. Firstly, Ghazali and Islam would not have become nearly as widespread as it did were it not for the infrastructure of the Seljuk state, in the form of the Nizamiya Madrasa system that was at the Imam's disposal. Secondly, how he was so well received in the East and the Centre can be contrasted with how he was rejected in the West. During the Middle Ages, 2 Yusufs gained legendary status for checking the aggression of militant Catholicism. Yusuf ibn Ayyub, also known as Salah ad-Din of the Crusades, and the lesser known Yusuf bin Tashfin, Sultan of the mighty and vast Almoravid Empire. The Tawaif rulers of Al-Andalus, as the petty Arab principalities of the Iberian Peninsula were then known, were on the brink of being overrun by the forces of El Bravo, King Alfonso VI of Castile. When in 1085, the Tawaif King of Seville, Al-Mu'tamid bin Abad, resolved to invite Yusuf bin Tashfin to come to the aid of the Spanish Muslims, his son warned him that inviting the Berber Almoravids into Spain would spell the end of their own Arab rule. To which the king said to the young prince, I have no desire to be branded by my descendants as the man who delivered Al-Andalus as prey to the disbelievers. I am loath to have my name cursed in every member. For my part, رأي الجمال في الصحراء خير من رأي الخنازير في قشطالة. I would rather be a camel driver in the Sahara than a swineherd in Castile. In 1086, at the Battle of Zallaqa, Yusuf ibn Tashfin delivered Alfonso a brilliant and crushing defeat, staving off the Catholic Reconquista for a further 4 centuries. Yusuf ibn Tashfin was an Athari in Aqidah. Many of the Sunni jurists of the time, including the Malikis whose school was prevalent in Al-Andalus and the Maghrib, praised the Almoravid Sultan. They also censured Ghazali's Sufi heresies. The pious and learned Sultan ordered Ghazali's Ihya burnt on account of its many blasphemies. Copies were collected and duly set ablaze in the courtyard of the Grand Mosque of Cordoba. Smarting from such a slight, Ghazali tasked his student, Ibn Tumart, to take revenge against the Almoravids. Like Ibn Tashfin, Ibn Tumart was a Berber, but unlike Ibn Tashfin, Ibn Tumart was a heretic. His doctrine divested Allah of his divine attributes even more forcefully than other Ash'aris, and he was so taken with occultism that he declared himself the chosen Mahdi. Ibn Tumart's rebellion against the Almoravids failed, but his followers, the Almohads, did eventually overrun the Almoravids. And although some of the Almohads may have been enlightened, the masochistic strain of Ibn Tumart re-emerged with the Almohad ruler, the self-styled Caliph al-Nasir, who, when in 1212 was presented with King John of England's request to be inaugurated into the religion of Islam, and thereafter turned the British Isles into an Islamic domain, the Sultan mocked the English king and derided him before his English embassy.
According to one chronicler, John decided at this point to join the enemy. In 1213, he sent a delegation to the Emir of Morocco, offering to adopt Islam and turn England into an Islamic country in return for protection. That would have turned history upside down.
But we digress. The point to emphasize is that there was no universal acceptance of Ghazali's doctrines, and his books were burned for their blasphemies in the enlightened western portion of the Islamic lands, much less they caused an anti-science revolution. Ghazali's impact is likely being exaggerated out of laziness, as it gives commentators a fall guy for the apparently sudden ushering in of the moribund Muslim millennium. And finally, if Tyson can be excused for failing to appreciate that Ghazali's mysticism, rather than his mantiq, may have had a greater stifling effect on Muslim intellectual development, what is an inexcusable oversight is that Tyson's main thesis is simply wrong. Islam's age of scientific discovery and technological advancement did not cease with Ghazali around the year 1100, but continued for a further 5 centuries.